You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
Deba, Xana whispered. There was more rubbish than there had been a moment before. The black plastic and the can and the newspapers had been joined by greasy hamburger wrappers, a grocery bag, several apple cores and scrunched up clear plastic. The rubbish rustled. More rolled into view. Chicken bones, empty tubes of toothpaste, a milk carton. Debris blocked off the way they'd come. The rubbish was moving towards them. It was coming against the wind. As the girls began to creep backwards, it seemed as if the rubbish realised they were onto it, and it sped up. The cartons and cans rolled in their direction. The paper fluttered for them as madly as agitated butterflies. The plastic bags reached out their handles and scrambled towards the girls, who screamed and ran. They heard the manic, wet rustle of predatory rubbish.
China Mieville is the author of the novels King Rat, Perdido Street Station, The Scar, and Iron Council, and the short story collection Looking for Jake. His new novel for younger readers is Un-Lun-Dun. Thank you for joining us, China.
Thank you for having me.
China, this is a really wonderful novel. I have to admit that when I first heard you are writing a novel for younger readers, I was a little bit skeptical because some of the stuff I really liked about your novels, Perdido Street Station, Scar, Iron Council, was how far over the top you went. And one of the things I think you've managed to do successfully is to go equally far over the top in your new novel, but still make it appropriate for younger readers, and I wondered if you'd like to discuss that.
Well, I mean, thank you. I'm very glad you think so. I mean, certainly, when I started writing on London, I was quite nervous because I'd always known that I wanted to write a novel for younger readers. I wanted to write a novel essentially for my sort of 10, 11-year-old self, but I'd never done it, so I was quite nervous as to whether or not I'd be able to. And in terms of the kind of going over the top thing, that was a pleasure, as it always is. I mean, I never have any problem kind of thinking up sort of strange situations and grotesqueries and monsters and all of that. I was concerned about, you know, whether I would be able to do the language, whether, you know, because some of my adult fiction has quite sort of baroque and opaque language in places, and I didn't know whether I could do that. And so I was, and also there's a slightly different sense of the fantastic with more of a kind of indulgence on kind of wordplay and, you know, punning and that kind of thing. So there's no question that I was quite nervous about it, but I sort of took 2 weeks as an experiment and decided I would take stock at the end of 2 weeks and see if I liked what I'd been doing. And it came quite quickly. I was writing it quite fast, which is normally for me is quite a good sign. I tend to write in quite concentrated bursts. And so I continued, and when it was done, I gave it to my publisher and my friends with a great deal of trepidation, but the response was mostly very good.
Tell us a little bit about, give us an idea of how the novel works, what we're getting into here. What is Un-Lun-Dun?
Well, it's a very, very classic shape of a novel in many respects, although in others I hope it has a kind of affectionate, argumentative relationship with certain classic ideas. But basically, you know, when I was as a younger reader, I mean, what I loved and was obsessed with was stories about, you know, children from our world falling down rabbit holes or walking through the mirror or pushing at the back of wardrobes, you know, and going into a fantastic world. And so I wanted to do, something that was both a homage to those books and also one of those books, you know, was just part of that tradition. And so what it is about two young girls from London who find their way into a kind of grungy, fantastic world, which is called Un-London. It turns out that all the cities of our world have what is called an ab-city, which is a kind of twisted magical reflection. So London has Un-London, Paris has Parisn't, Baghdad has Bagdidn't. We're doing this interview in San Francisco. You know, it's this kind of punning fantasy thing, and so basically the story revolves them falling into Un-London and then discovering that there's a great threat. There are certain monsters, and trying both to get out and to neutralize that threat.
I love this idea of the secret place novels, you know, these hidden secret worlds that are accessible only to the children. One of the things you do well with this book is the fantastic creeps into our world first. And I wonder if you care to talk about, is that how you got yourself into the world? You said that this wasn't something that was easy for you to write.
Well, it was easy. Well, easy is maybe too strong, but it wasn't that difficult for me to write. It was more a question that I was very nervous about it, mm-hmm. you know. No, I mean, the shape of the novel changed a few times. I mean, I knew that, you know, the bulk of it was going to be set in this, you know, fantasy world, this un-London. But I wanted to have that kind of intrusion of the fantastic into our world first, for several reasons. I mean, one was simply to be tantalizing, and one was because if you do that, I wanted to kind of neutralize the notion that the whole kind of un-London setting, you know, it was all a dream, you know, because I never much liked that. Even the Alice books, which I love passionately, you know, the idea that the kind of get-out clause for the fantasy, which is that actually it was just a dream, always sort of slightly disappointed me. And so by having an intrusion of the fantastic into our world before anything else, just a little bit, just enough to kind of give you a, hopefully give you a frisson, it kind of, the idea was to make it so that there's a kind of inevitable kind of seriousness about what's going on, sort of, you know, morally and so on, that this actually matters, you know, that this isn't just, you know, one of our protagonists isn't going to have turned out to have just fallen asleep and have dreamed all this. You know, this is really happening in this world and there are real consequences.
One thing about this book, it follows the nature of your other fantasies, if I can call them that. It's very urban, and lots of fantasy and children's fantasy as well is kind of rural. There's, you know, rolling fields and caves and pretty places. There's none of that here. Tell me a little bit about
no,
that.
No, there's not. But I mean, at the same time, I think, I mean, certainly what that is, you know, I mean, you're right. I'm a very kind of, in inverted commas, an urban writer. I mean, cities are very important to me and very kind of inspirational to me. But I think that, I mean, while it may be true that there's a reasonable number of, you know, younger sort of fantasies for younger readers that aren't, you know, that are more kind of rural, there are plenty that aren't. And I think, you know, I mean, for example, Philip Pullman's trilogy, you know, the kind of fantasticated Oxford of the first of those books is a, you know, an incredibly vivid urban setting. You know, it's not quite the same kind of urbanness as I do, but it's, you know, that kind of the city of spires is absolutely central to it. I think about something like Philip Reeve's book, Mortal Engines, you know, one of my favorite books of the last few years, fantastic book. It's all about cities. It's kind of camply about cities. It has cities as, you know, as protagonists that run around eating each other, you know. I mean, it's completely city based. So while it's true that, you know, cities are very important to me, I would be hesitant of claiming that I was doing anything, you know, massively new there, you know. And equally, I think that, you know, the flip side of that is, if you have a reputation as a writer who's interested in something, people will tend to focus on that. So that, you know, for me, you know, Iron Council, for example, my last adult novel, was, I think, you know, at least half of it, if not more, took place outside cities and was all about kind of wilderness landscapes and so on. But people very rarely talk about that. They still talk about, you know, how much I'm an urban writer because I had a reputation for being very interested in cities. And, you know, I don't mind that, but I do think there's a danger of a kind, you know, sort of self-replicating some of these ideas, you know, and actually don't necessarily always jibe with the way things are. But this one, yes, very, very urban.
You mentioned the Pullman books as examples. You also, in the front of this book, mentioned a couple of your influences that I think are not well known within the United States, and I wanted to talk about those.
Michael Larabetti.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about that.
He wrote a series of books. He's written many books, but he wrote a trilogy of books for children called the Borrible Trilogy, which is The Borribles Go for Broke, and Across the Dark Metropolis, that were out of print for many years and have recently, I think about 3-4 years ago, were brought back into print in a collected volume. And they're a fantastic series of of books, which basically the idea is that it's set in London. It's mostly in the 70s, which is when they were written, and it's a very kind of sort of gritty, dark, you know, in inverted commas, realistic London. Except that in this world, if children run away from home and live on the streets, they turn into a kind of feral elf where their ears become pointed and they never grow old. So they're kind of like Peter Pan, but a kind of a ruder version that steals from markets and, you know, wears ripped jeans and so on. And these books were massively influential on me, and I just thought they were completely outstanding children's books. And I feel in one way, although they have, you know, they're very respected, but I think in some ways they were too ahead of their time. I feel like if those books had been written 5 years ago, I think they would have been, you know, considered absolute modern classics. And I'm always, you know, I think they deserve to be. I think they are classics of children's fiction, and I hope more people will read them.
The other author who has been published for a while in the UK and is just now seeing publication in the United States is Walter Moores.
Yeah.
And I love those books. Captain Blueberry is just so outstanding, very reminiscent of Stanislaw Lem's kind of books. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, Walter Moores' books weren't books from my childhood in the same way that, you know, Lewis Carroll and De Lara Beattie and so on were, because his books only came out in England in the last few years. He's a German writer, and they were translated. He's quite a well-known German. He's well-known as a writer and as a comic strip artist and as an illustrator. And he has, I think, three books now that are set in this kind of wild, fantastic realm. And the first of them, and my favourite, is called The 13 and a Half Lives of Captain Bluebear. And it's a huge, very sprawling sort of romp through a very strange sort of fantasy landscape, kind of going from episode to episode, weird things happening to this rather adorable, very swashbuckling little blue bear. And the thing that really interested me about Walter Moores' work was there were two things. One was this kind of incredible joy of just the kind of, you know, the sort of epic storytelling romp. There's just, you know, it kind of... Romp sometimes sounds like it's a kind of backhanded compliment. I really mean it in this case. There's no denigration there. He just has an incredible pleasure in telling this extraordinary story that goes through all these amazing, ludicrous byways. And the other thing is that he illustrates his own books, and I really love his illustrations. He does very kind of strong-lined black and white pen and ink illustrations, which I think are beautiful. And I'm very interested in illustrated books. Undone is the first book I've done that I've done my own illustrations for. The book is illustrated by me. And so I got very interested in that whole question of the relationship between illustrations and text and so on, and was looking at a lot of the kind of classic illustrations. And Moores seems to me to be a you know, something of a modern classic. I think in 25 years' time, I hope and suspect that it'll be considered a recent classic.
Let's talk a little bit about the character, the child characters in Unlondon. One of the things you do that I really liked at the beginning was you fight against this tradition of there always being like a really bad peer group that really dislikes your main characters. Your main characters are pretty well adjusted at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about that.
Do you know what? I'm so glad you say that, and I'm really glad you sort of focused on that, because you're absolutely right. I mean, it seems to me that there are certain things which come up again and again in particularly fantasy books, such as, you know, uncaring parents, you know, parents that don't really understand their children, a child who is kind of bowed down by a kind of grubby reality that doesn't appreciate them, you know, the kind of the cruelty of peer groups, as you say, in school. And I didn't want to do any of those things. And I make no judgments. I mean, there are some great books that do use those. But particularly, for example, the peer group thing, I think there's an awful lot about sort of quite how awful, you know, children can be to each other, and, you know, the cruelty of peer groups and so on. And I'm not even necessarily saying that that's untrue. I mean, there are, you know, obviously there are cliques and they can be horrible. But there's something rather... I sort of feel like, in a way, it can be rather despairing of children in rather a nasty way, and that there's not enough talked about, you know, children who just get on and are nice to each other, and that, as you say, there's not particularly a problem, and I think that's quite important. And you know, similarly, one of the things I very much liked about Coraline, Neil Gaiman's book Coraline, is that Coraline's parents, they're not bad people. They're not neglecting her. You know, there's no sense that this is an escape into a fantasy world, which, you know, seems to me to be a very backhanded way of dealing with the fantastic. And I just wanted to think about, you know, I wanted this to be a book that quite likes people. You know, this is a book that thinks people are basically pretty decent most of the time, and that includes young people, you know. So I'm really glad you said that.
One of the things that interests me is what we're going to talk when we talk about this book. I do want to say that we're going to talk about, if you want to remain totally fresh, I recommend you read this book immediately and then come back and listen to the interview and enjoy the insights of the author. But we're going to discuss some aspects of things that occur farther into the text, and I want to let the listeners know that, not to give any spoilers, but again, totally fresh. One of the things that's interesting in this book is the relationship between the two main characters that we meet at first, Xana and Deba. Tell us a little bit about when you were doing this, it feels like you discovered something happening here.
Well, I'd always known that, and as you say, this isn't exactly, you know, these aren't huge, huge spoilers, but, you know, this does discuss certain sort of twists and turns of the book. So I think the reader should be, you know, sort of forewarned of that. But with that caveat, I mean, when I wrote this book, I always knew that I wanted to write something which had a sort of a relatively disrespectful or argumentative attitude to questions of fate and destiny, and you know that one of the classic figures is the kind of the chosen one, you know, the one chosen by destiny to do certain things. And the reason that I wanted to be a bit argumentative about that is because as a very young reader, I was always put off by books that involved a lot of stuff like that and that had characters who, you know, were prophesied to be the kind of saviors of the land and so on, for various reasons. I mean, one of them being that I sort of felt if something was written, if it was destined that this character was going to do certain things, then I kind of knew what was going to happen, and I didn't really find that terribly interesting. And the other was that I felt that it meant that their supporting characters, their friends, their sidekicks, got rather condescended to by the narrative, and they were, you know, they weren't really treated as, you know, fully rounded characters. They were supporting players, and I always felt that was a bit disrespectful. And I think partly because I never really felt like, you know, like a chosen one. I always felt more like a sidekick, you know. And I always felt very sorry for people like, you know, like Velma and rather than Daphne and Scooby Doo and, you know, all this, you know, the sidekicks I felt got a kind of a hard time. So in terms of those two characters, I knew from quite early on that what I wanted to do was have you know, a chosen one and her friend, but then have a kind of, you know, a disrespectful relationship to the ways that might seem to conventionally play out, and who does what and who ends up sort of, you know, saving the day and so on. But at the same time, I didn't want to get involved, for similar reasons to what you were saying about the cliques, I didn't want to turn it into a kind of resentment thing. I mean, Deba genuinely loves Xana. They are, you know, it's not about a kind of the resentment of the friend, of the sidekick. So I wanted to sort of look at an idea of, you know, people kind of pushed into situations that they hadn't planned on being in, and sort of struggling to make the best of things because they're basic, you know, because they're decent people, you know. And it was quite important to me that these two characters be genuine, sincere, close friends.
It also suggests this idea that what we do matters. Mm. That it's what we do. It's not where we start or what we're given at the beginning. It's really what we do that matters. And that's an interesting theme.
Well, I mean, again, I wouldn't sort of claim to be, you know, the first person saying this, but yeah, I mean, I there is a fair bit of, you know, of children's fiction still, which has, you know, the character who is the main character by virtue of their birth, or by virtue of the fact that they have inherited magical powers, or that they have, that they come from a bloodline of this, that, and the other. And I just don't like that idea, and I prefer the idea of, you know, seeing what people who aren't chosen do. That's just more interesting to me.
Part and parcel of any kind of fantasy like this are the fantastic characters, and you have some really interesting fantastic characters in Unlundone once they enter the Ab City. I'd like you to talk about Obadiah Fing, who's a really interesting character in a number of ways. Tell us a little bit about
Obadiah. He's essentially a kind of tailor and couturier. He designs clothes. He makes clothes out of books. He has various different sort of, from our perspective, bizarre fashion ideas. He mentions a few of them in passing, but the one he's working on at the moment is clothes made out of books, and his sort of fantastic shtick is that he, as someone who, you know, works with fabric and so on, he always needs pins and needles, and his head is a pincushion. So he, what looks at first like his hair is actually a kind of plethora of pins and needles sticking out, and he sort of takes them out and sticks them in without any discomfort and so on. And he, you know, is a character in this because he makes friends with the main character, and is what I wanted to do was try and depict somebody who, again, is, you know, trying to do their best against, you know, nasty, difficult, you know, evil situations, but is fundamentally something of a coward and is trying to, you know, but not a bad person by any means, and is sort of struggling against their own innate fearfulness. So that's what I just wanted to do with him.
I also really liked the Umbrellissimo. And this gets us into an aspect of your books I always enjoy, and a part of our conversations I always enjoy. Let's talk about the monsters. In the early passages of this book, you describe something. I was reading this book, and it's when they're still in the real world. You describe something crawling along the street and up the window, and I'm just thinking, oh my God, what is this horrific monster? Tell us what it is and how you wrestled the language to turn what it is into that horrific alien-like monster.
What it is, it's an umbrella. Specifically, it's a broken umbrella. And again, that was an image that I'd actually, a lot of the images in this book, and that was one of them, was things that I'd had kind of kicking around in my head for a long time, many years in some cases. And the idea of broken umbrellas as a kind of grotesque creature was just because, you know, every time it rains in London, and I'm sure other cities as well, loads and loads of people's umbrellas, you know, break and they just get discarded. And when you look, you know, when you're walking around London in the rain, the pavements are kind of dotted with these very strange things, which, you know, a broken umbrella looks like a kind of, like some weird coagulum of like a dead crow and some kind of cyborgy robot. And, you know, it's got all this kind of metal ribs and things and leather and flaps and so on. And I just thought there was something, it looks like a very grotesque sort of mixture of the artifact and the organic. And I just thought they just looked really cool. So for many years I'd had this notion about like a flock of broken umbrellas, and you know what they would do, and what the umbrellas would, you know, where they would want to go, and so on, and why. And so in this particular book, I just kind of took that further, and I was able to kind of indulge that idea. And so the idea of flocks of broken umbrellas and where they end up going is where all the kind of discards go, and the rubbish and the trash goes, which is in London. So they're just kind of one piece of animate garbage among many, but they're, I think, for me the most kind of scary.
This brings up this idea that you create called Moyle. Mm. Which is what much of Unlondon is based on. This is a really fascinating idea and has a lot of interesting implications. And I'm wondering if you think those implications are lost on the younger readers, or Tell us a little bit. What is moil?
Moil is a category of stuff which stands for mildly obsolete in London, moil. And it's basically things which are broken. The idea being, if you leave things that are broken just alone, you throw them away, eventually they kind of seep through the fabric of reality into un-London. And in un-London, those things which are broken and thrown away have a kind of new lease of life. And they have a new lease of life in various ways. Some of them literally become, you know, animate and wander around. Some of them new, and this I suspect is where you're talking about the sort of subtext, you know, new uses are found for them. So you have like moil houses in London, which are just houses made of where the bricks are old record players and, you know, CDs and washing machines and so on. And so you have this kind of patchwork of trash turned into a house. In terms of, I mean, you know, you tell me if I've got the right idea, but I suspect you're talking about, you know, notions of kind of reusing old things and so
sure,
on.
Sure.
Well, the thing is, you're right to the extent that inevitably there is, I suppose, the ramifications of some of the kind of monsters and some of, you know, ideas like moil in the book are a kind of ecological themes and notions of recycling and so on and so forth. But you say, you know, do I think that'll pass kids by? Well, for a start, you know, the purpose of the book is not to instill those ideas. The purpose of the book is to tell a cool story with monsters. You know,
good.
So if
mission
the,
accomplished.
Okay. So if children read it and they don't come away with any sort of, you know, ecological ideas, I'm really not bothered. You know, that's not what it was for. You know, and if I want to make an argument about ecology or politics or anything, I'll just do so. You know, so this was a story that is self-contained. You know, of course, that doesn't mean I'm not interested in those ideas, and I fully see the kind of the ramifications. And if that's the kind of thing that interests some people, and they find a certain texture in the book which they enjoy or they want to argue with, then that's great. That's all to the good. But you want to kind of have your cake and eat it. That those textures are there for people who are interested in them. But that if you're not interested, then the story is its own end as well. And I would also really want to stress that there's the line of causality here is absolutely not that I set out by thinking I want to tell a children's story which has a kind of, you know, strong theme about recycling. What can I do? What happens is I have always been really fascinated, ever since I was very young, with trash landscapes, always. Not because I think of what they mean, but because of how they look. I just think they're extraordinary. They have a kind of beauty, a grotesque beauty, but, you know, amazing. And so, you know, and the idea of, like, monsters made of rubbish and, you know, intelligent, you know, clouds of pollution and that kind of thing, I thought that was just a really cool, grotesque idea. So I start with that and I say, you know, I want un-London to be a, you know, an ab city full of these extraordinary kind of reconfigured trash, you know. And then from there, I sort of thought, well, you know, one of the ideas that throws up is certain ideas about ecology and so on. So maybe I'll play around with that. But that came after. I start with the grotesque and then the themes follow. And because I'm known as a political writer, no one ever believes that, but it is the truth. I start with the grotesque and then the themes, you know.
Well, I think that's pretty evident because this book really is, it's a ripping yarn. And the monsters are just fantastic and it really catches you up. And this brings me to a point I wanted to ask about. You do some really interesting thing, too, with mixing different levels and different sorts of myths in here. What struck me most was Rosa the bus driver. Am I right in thinking that this is maybe an allusion to Rosa Parks?
Do you know what? I'm sorry to be disappointing, but actually not.
Oh,
no.
Really?
I mean, at least not consciously. I mean, whenever I'm asked about, you know, was this an allusion to such and such, I always feel I always want to sort of answer, you know, I can only tell you what was consciously in my own mind. But, you know, writers' consciousnesses of their own books are, you know, deeply flawed instruments, you know. And I think, you know, writers very often do not by any means have the best idea of what's going on in their own work. And sometimes I think writers are, you know, categorically wrong about their own books, and what they think they're doing and what they're actually doing are two completely different things. So I can only say to you that at a conscious level, I was not thinking about Rosa Parks at that point. I like London buses. I like the name Rosa. It was just a kind of a nice setup, but it would be foolish of me to say that that was categorically not going on somewhere in my mind. But I can only speak for the conscious, the forebrain.
Tell us a little bit. Let's talk about language in this book, which is really fun, and it's a really important part. In the American edition, you give a warning about the Britisms, and we get a list of those at the back. Is that presumably that's not in the British edition?
No, it's not. I mean, it fascinates me all the time the extent to which, you know, British English and American English, although we mostly understand each other fine, I think there are many more differences than people generally think. I'm constantly coming across words that you don't use that we do use and vice versa. And also, you know, really strange little phrases that we do share for no discernible reason. And then what seem to me to be quite straightforward phrases we don't share. So when I was, when I was finishing this, I spoke to the publisher, the editor, and he went through and made a list of the words that he thought particularly younger readers in the States would maybe not understand. For example, what we call an estate in a city, you call a housing project, you know. And I couldn't use the term housing project because it's so American. It wouldn't ring true for London. But I know if I said estate without explaining, then some readers might think it's like a big country house, you know, and that would have given very much the wrong idea. So we put stuff like that in the glossary. And there were two phrases which we actually did change for the American edition, which is the word flashlight, which we don't use. We use torch. But I gather that would make people think of kind of burning brands, and that's not the idea. And the word rappel, as in to rappel down a wall. We don't rappel, we abseil.
Oh.
And those were the two words that we changed. That and all the spellings, obviously. But, yeah.
You also have a lot of fun with neologisms and just shifting words around, like choisi versus choisi. Tell us a little bit about creating some of these neologisms. And just bringing language to life.
Well, I like inventing words. I always have, and I like inventing words that have a kind of that do have an internal logic. So I don't just pluck phonemes out of the air. They are they have a kind of etymology, but they're also invented. And I probably my favorite in this book is an arachnophenestronaut, which is somebody who travels through a spider window, and it's a very, it's very easy to invent. It's arachnophenestronaut, each component, means spider window traveler. It's something I've done with all the books is invent, neologisms and so on. And in this one, I definitely kind of indulged in a lot of wordplay, sometimes really grown-worthy puns. I like puns, stupid puns, and so there's a lot of punning, which I then took very literally and like a kind of a bad pun, but then you treat it as if it's a kind of real taxonomic category or something, and you sort of invent a creature based on a misheard word, that kind of thing. And in terms of the inventions like moil, like arachnophenestronaut, things like that, I mean, the intention is to make something which makes reasonable sense for the world you've created, but which has enough playfulness in it that readers will maybe get a kick out of them.
I love that you also literally bring language to life. In the talk lands, tell us a little bit about the Utterlings.
That's a section in the book where there's a character who, Mr. Speaker, who every word that he speaks is made flesh as a sort of unique, strange, mouthless animal. So when he speaks, he becomes sort of these creatures drop out of his mouth, and he becomes surrounded by these kind of basically living words. That was an idea I'd had for a very long time, and these are called the Utterlings, those words. And partly, again, we've talked about the kind of relationship between the grotesque and ideas and themes. I started off with this idea of the kind of the animal, the word made into an animal, And then it also sort of, what that allowed me to do was have a kind of playful but fairly serious sort of debate and discussion about, you know, the philosophy of language. And there's a scene in which one, you know, the protagonist argues with Mr. Speaker about the Utterlings and what they can do and what they can't do and so on. And that's actually me kind of having a sort of, you know, having a little discussion about what language is and the way we use language and how language works and the extent to which it's communal, the extent to which we control it, you know, that kind of thing. And as I always say, as I said before, I mean, the idea is, you know, for people who are interested in, you know, the philosophy of language, that section is a kind of, you know, has some stuff that I'm, you know, I'd like to sort of, you know, talk about, you know, and it has a couple of references to quite specific philosophers in it, which I think mm-hmm. people who are interested in that stuff might spot. But for those, you know, many thousands who that isn't their draw, it's also, I just think, a cool idea, you know, words made flesh. And this guy who, you know, every time he speaks, these strange animals drop out of his mouth. So, yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes.
Tell us a little bit about the philosophers behind that you had in mind that were born out of your grotesque imagination.
Well, I mean, for example, just to give you one example, and I do really stress, because this is going to sound incredibly kind of dry and professorial, I really stress that this is, you know, this is not necessary for the enjoyment of the scene. This is purely for that tiny minority of readers who are going to be interested in it. But there's a point at which, during the argument, the protagonist says, you know, if you shout across a road at your friend and you shout, "Hey, you," and the wrong person turns round, and, you know, she's using this to illustrate a point about how language isn't always under our control, even our own language. And that's actually a reference to a fairly well-known sort of philosophical, political argument by the French philosopher Althusser, where he's talking about ideology and his concept of interpolation. So for those who are interested in that kind of thing, there's an Althusser joke in that chapter. But for those many who aren't, there's also, you know, cool animal words.
I'm with the cool animal words.
Excellent.
Tell us a little.
I'm with both. You see,
yeah. Tell us a little bit about the book steps. I love the scenes with the book steps and the book tunnel. This is more. There seems a point in this book where you really just like delve into books and language. And is this something you felt that when you were writing it too?
Yeah. Well, I mean, partly, you know, when you have a thing which is set in a fantasy world, one of the big questions is, you know, how do you get your protagonist from our world to the fantasy? What is the nature of the portal? You know, how do they go through? How do they cross over? And there's various different ways that they cross over in this book. But one of the ways they cross over is by what are called book steps and story ladders. And what that is basically if you sort of start if you take a bookshelf and you start climbing on it, treating it like a ladder. The idea being that you just sort of keep going up and that you pass through a realm of very strange books and then you emerge in a very different world. And partly what that was an idea that, you know, I like the idea of, I always, as a kid, because you could never reach the top shelf of the books as a kid. You could never reach, you know, the books on the top shelf. And there was always this idea of, you know, just kind of clambering up to get them, but you weren't quite sure if the shelves would take your weight and all that kind of thing. And partly because, you know, so much of my youth was spent reading books in libraries and getting this incredible pleasure out of kind of, you know, reading these, you know, these kind of fantastic worlds. And you quite often hear that people saying that, you know, books and libraries in particular, you know, are gateways to other worlds for children. And so I wanted to say, well, OK, let's take that literally, you know, let's kind of literalize that idea and say that, you know, you literally can use books and bookshelves as a ladder out of, you know, to kind of get out into a fantasy world. So it is something which is, there is obviously that kind of metaphor of, you know, of traveling through books. But I hope it's not too heavy-handed. It's also intended to just be, you know, an interesting scene with a character, you know, going through a strange universe of bookshelves. I discovered after I'd written it, actually, that Arthur Machen, the great sort of English the great British sort of Gothic fiction writer of the early 20th century, when he lived in a garret in London, he didn't have enough bookshelves. So one of the things he did was he had a little ladder out onto his roof, and he used to use the steps of the ladder as a bookshelf, and he used to fill his ladder steps with his books, which I was really delighted by, because it felt like a kind of back reference to history of this idea, you know, a ladder used as a bookshelf, and vice versa. So that was the idea behind that.
Let's talk a little bit about the illustrations. When you created them, did you write the text first and then create the illustrations?
I did, but I always had a very strong visual sense of many of the scenes, because I think very visually, and because I tend to sketch as I go along. I tend to do quite a lot of doodles and try and kind of get things clear in my head through these illustrations. And what happened was, when I finished the book and I gave it to my publishers, both here and in Britain, they both said, you know, well, we're going to get this illustrated. And because I'd already done some illustrations by that time, because I tend to draw most of the things I write, including my adult novels, but I'd never sort of put them out there for publication before. And so when they said they were going to get it illustrated, I quite shyly said, well, you know, if you're interested, I have a few pictures that you can look at. And so they took a look at them. But I was very concerned that it not look like a vanity project, because I wasn't used to, you know, putting my illustrations out there. So when we were talking about it, I was very adamant with the publishers at all points that they didn't have to use them. This wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to mind if they said that they didn't like the illustrations, that, you know, it wasn't a, you know, a condition for, you know, for publishing anything like that. But they both sort of, you know, they liked them. So with some trepidation and also great, you know, excitement, I sort of said, okay, well, you know, and I did several more, and now they're out there, they're in the text.
One of the things that's interesting about the illustrations is you use them to tell the story, parts of the story that you're not telling in the text, to foreshadow. And I'm thinking about just the way that some of the characters look, even though we're hearing kind of good things about the characters on the page, when we look at the picture, go, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, there's one that I think I can, I know the scene you're talking about, and there's one picture which, you know, I think when you first see it, I'm hoping that it's relatively ambiguous, you know,
yeah.
But it fairly clearly, when you then later on discover things that do happen and you look back, you can maybe see the seeds of, you know, your discovery there as well. I mean, I was quite careful with the pictures. So if you go through, you notice, for example, none of the main characters are ever drawn. Mm-hmm. I tended to illustrate either things that were happening sort of, you know, in the corner of the page, as it were, or relatively minor characters, the actual, you know, sort of second row characters, the actual kind of core of main characters don't really get illustrated. And part of the reason for that was I didn't want to kind of tie it down in the reader's head so that, you know, they had to consider Zanna or Deba as looking a certain way. So I wanted to kind of keep a certain kind of freedom for their own mind. And also because I think the idea for illustrations is to be, should be to be sort of suggestive and pique your interest as much as to be authoritative and sort of close things down. So that's why it's quite often the kind of slightly less crucial thing that gets the big illustration. It's meant to be sort of partly tantalizing.
Yeah.
Except the Utterlings. I had to draw all the Utterlings because that was just too much fun.
Well, I'm glad you focused on the monsters and the kind of the weird grotesqueries, because that's where my interests lie.
Absolutely, and that's also more fun to draw.
I imagine so. One thing that's interesting about this book is that you combine wonder and terror. And you do it quite effectively. There's a scene on the roof world. First off, roof world. Christopher Fowler?
Yes, but not just him. I mean,
no.
the idea of people running across roofs and living in the roofs as a kind of alternative landscape is... Roof world is obviously the most, you know, the most sustained, but it's an idea that's been done in many, many different fantasy books.
Well, that it sent me running to my bookshelves to see if I could find the damn thing again. Tell us a little bit about this kind of, I think, dichotomy and the similarity with the wonder and terror. You have these light bulb insects, and you have something that involves, you know, a basket of fruit, shall we say, that is beautiful. These things are beautiful and terrifying at once.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I mean, certainly that's the idea. I wanted some of the creatures, I mean, my favorite example is probably the Black Windows, which are intended to be both, you know, if you stop and you take a moment, the very idea, you know, of the Black Window is kind of completely ludicrous. But within the context of the book, it is also meant to be genuinely quite frightening, you know, when it occurs, you know, when that scene happens. And I think what I wanted to do was, as a kid, I really, and indeed now, but, you know, as a younger reader, I really enjoyed being frightened. I enjoyed being scared by scary books, by gothic books, by, you know, by monsters. And I worry sometimes that some children's sort of fiction and films and so on is a little bit nervous of trying to be scary. And so quite often, it, you know, the villains or whatever will be kind of almost comedic, almost played for laughs rather than trying to be kind of genuinely frightening. And I think, I mean, there are exceptions to this and there are genuinely scary stuff, but I don't think one should have any kind of anxiety about, you know, trying to be really scary at times. And so I wanted to have some monsters in there that, you know, even if looked at with a kind of, you know, with one eye slightly closed, you could see that they were a really sort of silly idea or a really sort of, there was a joke behind them or whatever. They also are played quite straight. They're played quite seriously as genuinely, you know, sort of frightening creatures. And in terms of the kind of, you know, the relation between, you know, beauty and terror, I mean, it's all, you know, sort of a subspecies of awe, isn't it? And awe is a very ambivalent emotion because it can go either way very easily.
One thing that you mentioned in this book is an occult war in London, and I'm wondering if this is a reference to the Dion Fortune.
Again, not specifically.
Because it's an
interesting. You're making the books. It's obviously I'm much less of an interesting referential writer than you think I am. All these things that you think I'm referencing, I'm just not. At least not consciously. I mean, there are plenty of references in the book, but not that specifically. No. I mean, again, you know, the idea of the kind of hidden occult war is not, you know, I mean, it's been used many times. So I was quite aware that there was a sort of a tradition of that idea, but not that specifically.
Let's talk a little bit about your short story collection, Looking for Jake. It's one of the things that you have in there is a story called On the Way to the Front. It's a graphic story, illustrated. And I'm wondering, would you write a Batman story if they asked you?
I would certainly consider it, yeah. I mean, that comic that you're talking about is done by Liam Sharp, the illustrator. It's a fantastic piece of work. I know a lot of readers didn't really like that comic. I thought it was fantastic, and I still do. I loved it.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Well, thank you. I think his art is superb, and I really like that piece. I'm very interested in writing for comics, and I have actually sort of spoken about this to various comic people, and, you know, it's been mooted about, you know, writing both in a sort of, you know, including for some kind of, you know, fairly, you know, big classic figures like, you know, the ones you're talking about. But obviously, you know, and perfectly understandably, there are fairly sharp constraints on what you can do if you're dealing with a big, you know, big franchise character. So, I have no objection in principle. I'd have to be able to come up with, I wouldn't say yes just on principle and then, you know, and then work out the details afterwards. What I would want to do is I would want to say, well, here's some ideas for stories. Are you going to be happy with those? Are you going to let, you know, is that going to work for you? Because if you do stuff in comics, you're collaborating, and it has to be a collaboration, you know, which all the partners are happy with, you know. So I'm very open to the idea, but, you know, inevitably there's more kind of give and take involved. And, you know, if we could come up with something that kept everyone sort of happy and that felt like it was still in my voice, then yes, I'd be delighted. I mean, I grew up on these things, so yeah.
One of the kind of sub-themes in the stories in Looking for Jake is you have some kind of interesting versions of the apocalypse. Mm. You have a Borgesian apocalypse, and you have what you call, and I love this phrase, an inexact apocalypse. Tell us a little bit about that. I love that idea.
Well, I mean, as a general theme, the idea of the kind of the post-apocalypse narrative is something that I've always loved. It's a fairly standard idea, you know, be it a nuclear war, be it some sort of magical meltdown. And I really enjoy that. And I wanted to write some stories that were sort of part of that tradition, homages to that. The Inexact Apocalypse story is the title story, which is Looking for Jake itself. And it's the only thing I've ever written that is taken almost without any filigrees at all from a dream. That entire story was dreamed.
Really?
More or less beginning to end. Yeah. Not that phrase, I have to say. That phrase was I came up with afterwards. But yeah, I mean, it's the only time I don't tend to remember my dreams except in fragments, but that was one of the exceptions. And that story was, as I say, more or less simply a transcription of a dream. And I just like the idea of, you know, doing a kind of a post-apocalypse story, but not really specifying exactly what the apocalypse was and still trying to do the story. I just thought that was an interesting idea. But it was an idea because of the dream, I have to say. So I can't take credit. My subconscious has to take credit.
One story that I really liked was reports of certain events in London. Mm. And the reason that kind of stuck in my mind was I just talked to Rudy Rucker. And he has this genre of fiction he calls transrealism. And here is an absolutely perfect example of transrealism. Was this written with Rudy Rucker in mind, or
no? I mean, it's an idea. You know, the central idea behind reports of certain events in London. I mean, what actually one of the spurs for that story, because that story features me as a character. It opens with, you know, China Mieville receiving some mail, and what the story opens with me complaining about the fact that my mail is clearly being opened en route, and this was true. I mean, I went through a period a few years ago when particularly things that were coming internationally, just everything, not everything, but a lot of the stuff I got looked to me quite clearly to have been opened and checked up en route. And I was in this kind of outrage and sort of, not knowing what to do about this. And that kind of gave me the idea of sort of finding yourself in the middle of a kind of fight or war or debate between forces that neither of which you really understood, so that you were kind of caught in the middle of something strange kind of by accident or possibly by accident. And then and it's very unusual for me to use those kind of techniques of sort of using myself as a character and so on, that kind of I don't tend to do that kind of thing, but for that story it was absolutely right. And then much of the rest of it is, you know, about the kind of the shifting city and so on, you know, sort of not being able to kind of map the city in a stable fashion and so on. These are the kind of concerns I always have, and just kind of made, you know, written with a certain amount of sort of streets that aren't always where you think they are and that move around and so on. It was just written with a kind of kind of literalizing that anxiety in a very sort of clear way. In terms of the whole kind of transrealist thing and so on, I mean, I like schools and movements and polemics and manifestos. I think they're fun. I think they're interesting. And I like the way genre fiction, science fiction, fantasy, horror throws up these plethora of, you know, interstitial arts, transrealism, new weird, and it throws them up and swallows them again, rat bastards, you know, and so on and so on and so on. And I think the key is with all of them, you know, not to take them too seriously, but then at the same time not to be kind of narrowly, pompously sectarian about them. They're provocations, they're ways of thinking about things. So, you know, bring it on.
I'm interested also in Tis the Season. Mm. Tell us a little bit about the premise of that story, and I'm wondering if this is a digital rights management time for you.
Tis the Season's a story written set in the near future at a time when everything to do with Christmas has become copyrighted and trademarked, so that you can't celebrate Christmas, you can't have a Christmas tree. Christmas has a little TM next to it. You can't, you know, putting presents under trees is proprietary. You can't, you don't have the right to. It's called, if you don't have a license to do that, it's called subarboreal giftery, and it's a crime. So it's just taking the kind of commodification of everything to a kind of ridiculous extreme. I was asked by a left-wing magazine to write a socialist review to write a Christmas story, and I really it appealed to me enormously, the idea of trying to write, you know, a kind of, you know, a sort of genuine, warm-hearted Christmas story for a kind of militant, secular, left-wing magazine. I thought that was delightful. That was also, you know, that took political ideas but didn't treat them too po-facedly. So it's just an attempt to write a kind of light-hearted, sort of polemical Christmas story. And the whole issue of commodification and the sort of, you know, the copywriting of everything and patenting of everything, you know, and that sort of thing is a, you know, intellectual property and so on, you know, is of great concern to me, as it is of many people. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, play with a sort of, play with that in a kind of, in a lighthearted, but, you know, a lighthearted manner, but, you know, it's a serious issue underneath.
You'll be attending the H.P. Lovecraft Conference, Weird Realism, of Lovecraft in Theory. Tell us a little bit about this and what drew you to it.
Well, I was asked by one of the organizers who runs a blog called K-Punk, and you know, he and various other sort of philosophers and theorists and so on. It's this one day event in London in next month, and basically, I mean, I really like Lovecraft. And I'm very interested in philosophy and social theory and so on. And there is a small but quite solid kind of tradition of often French theorists, social theorists, philosophy theorists, who are obsessed with Lovecraft. You know, in the kind of Anglo-American tradition, that's quite difficult to believe in some ways, because Lovecraft tends to be the preserve of, you know, the weird fiction people and, you know, social theorists and so on. On the whole, you know, unless they happen to be horror fans, don't tend to be particularly interested in him. But, you know, for example, you take, you know, writers like Deleuze and Guattari, you know, sort of hugely important in kind of you know, sort of radical philosophy of the 60s and 70s and 80s. You know, their books contain loads of references to Lovecraft. You know, and they use him as a kind of paradigm for thinking about sort of decentering ontology and all sorts of, you know, all sorts of those kind of things. And so because I've always been, I don't have a, you know, my background is in social theory, and I, you know, I write weird fiction and I'm a big admirer of Lovecraft. And so when I was invited to come along to this, I just thought it was a really interesting piece of sort of cross-fertilization. I have to say, in much of the continent, it's not quite as odd as it sounds to the sort of Anglo-American ear. But I'm hoping it'll, you know, start an interesting conversation, as they say.
Well, Uella Beck's Lovecraft piece was just published by McSweeney's Press here in the U.S., and it was really a fascinating little book, and I think that he is starting to, and it was recently published by the American Library, so he's starting to, the perceptions of this writer is really starting to shift.
That's right. I did an introduction to The Mountains of Madness, which was which I drew on the Welbeck essay a fair bit. I thought it was a very, very interesting piece of work, and you know, the whole question of the relationship between Lovecraft's grotesque and his racism, and you know, whether or not that, you know, you have to sort of take that very seriously, but then the question of whether or not that kind of delegitimates his fiction, which I think it does not. I think the fiction is magnificent, but it is also predicated on a certain kind of racism, and you have to just deal with that, and Welbeck, I think, does a brilliant job of discussing that, and he's certainly, you know, one of the figures who I'm quite sure will come up at this discussion.
Tell us a little bit about what's in store for you. And I'm particularly interested, your work is so visual. Are there any movies? Is somebody going to attempt to film one of your things?
Well, I mean, I hope so. I like the idea. I mean, I grew up on movies, so, you know, I'd be very interested in that. And certainly there are discussions, let's put it that way. But I think, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, Un-London in particular, I think would translate very nicely into film, and I'd be interested in that. But I think if you're talking about that kind of translation, it is sensible to be quite sort of cautious about setting your heart on anything, because you'll probably be disappointed. So at this, you know, until I'm in a movie theater and the lights are going down and you know, a screen is coming up that says, you know, from the story by China Mieville, I'll wait. But certainly one of my short stories is currently sort of under development, and there are discussions going on about some of the other stuff too. I'm very open to it. Although I would also, I mean, particularly with the Bass Lag books, I would be quite anxious about what kind of job they would do. I worry that I would be too anxious about them being sort of faithful, because I think if you're very worried about people being faithful, you may well be disappointed. So I'm very open to it, but I'd want to sort of talk about it quite carefully and work out what their plans were and so on.
What about your next book?
Well, I'm working on something at the moment which is set in the real world, but, you know, of course, with various, you know, monsters and fantastic elements. And that's another adult book. And then there are various possibilities for what I might do after that. And I would very much like to do another YA book. I mean, I enjoyed writing On London hugely, and the response has mostly been very, very nice. So I fully intend to do another, possibly set in the same universe, because there's plenty of room for more exploration.
Yes. We've been speaking with China Mieville. His new novel is On London. Thank you for joining me, China.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.